think one of the issues for Christians is how do you use our hope, or how does our hope in the afterlife and in the beatific vision and in being in union with God, how does that inspire hope for our action here on earth?
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Sons of Ignatius podcast. My name is Father David Lugo and I'm joined as always by my good friend Father Niall Leahy. How you doing, bud?
I'm doing good, Dave. I'm doing good. Thank you. We are in the middle of the novena to the Sacred Heart here at Gardiner Street Parish in Dublin. So feeling the joys of that and feeling the consolation of so many people coming to the church and praying, which is lovely. And just that general feeling of the year kind of winding down a little bit and a sort of quieter time of summer and holidays and vacation coming up as well and retreat. So yeah, it's a nice time of year.
Good, good. Yeah, it's a weird thing in our life since we spend most of our time as Jesuits in school settings that for me, the end of the year is always the beginning of summer, you know? And it's like, I'm not sure that the corporate world thinks that way, you know? And so yeah. I also have this feeling of things are coming to a close because I'm getting ready to leave. So like this episode marks the end of my sitting in this office here in Miami to record our podcast. So like our next episode that we'll record together after a little bit of a summer break, I'll be sitting in my office in Spain. So I'll be moving to Madrid, as I've been saying a few episodes now, but definitively, this is my last time sitting here as we record. And so the next time you'll hear my voice, I'll be a lot closer to you now, both in heart and in geography.
That's fantastic. So it's the end of a chapter, Dave, a short one for you.
That's right.
End of your pastoral year in Miami. And I'm really happy that you're coming to Europe, to Madrid. One, I suppose, because you're going to be doing a PhD in Ignatian spirituality and you have intellectual gifts and you have a really heartfelt interest in Ignatius and his writings and his spirituality. So I'm delighted for you that you're going to get the chance to really immerse yourself in all that. And please God, get your PhD in good time and write on something you're really interested in. And I think that's going to be a huge, you're going to be a huge resource for the church going forward.
Yeah, yeah.
Being able to teach on this stuff. I have to say, just doing the podcast with you, there's been times when you've just spoken very easily and fluidly about Ignatius or something about theology. And I've been like, geez, Dave really knows stuff. Like, wow.
Wait a minute. He might actually be talking something that I don't know. This is great. This is awesome. That's how often, generally, Niall, if you can get 5% of what I say as inspiring, that's about 95% of what I hear from you. When you talk to me about things, I'm like, Niall talks about all these things with so much fluidity. Either he's a really good Irishman and can just tell a good story, or he's actually got some chops and some things. Well, I got to say, I do look forward to being an asset to the society and not so much a liability. If I had to choose between the two, I think I'd rather be the asset and not the liability.
You're going to be a great asset. I know that. A great support to a lot of people.
Thanks, man. Before we get into the swing of this episode, which will just be a really wonderful time to just recollect on some of the graces of this first year of the podcast and my pastoral year, and it is coming to a close, and I think I mentioned this when we first started, that I was only here for 10 months, provisionally, as you said, and it's been a wonderful time. I have been very grateful for this experience, but it's also been very difficult. To put a note on the transition to doctoral studies, there's a great wisdom, I think, in our formation where giving guys a pastoral experience before they do intensive study is not only good psychologically, just to take a breath, but also I'm going back to studies after having left studies with a whole year of experiences and questions that I'm like, ooh, if I had not done this year, I don't think I'd be asking these questions in the same way. I've had a lot of wonderful grace moments in the confessional, some really difficult, thorny moral issues and questions in the confessional. I've had struggles with interpreting scripture for preaching, spiritual direction and accompanying vocations. And all that stuff is going to go into my doctoral studies with a lot of renewed curiosity, which I think is a really great way of thinking. One of the things that you've been talking about a lot with that Ignatian paradigm of experience then leads to reflection, which then leads to action. I've been feeling that a lot this year on a macro level for the pastoral year.
That's fantastic, Dave. I mean, part of what makes really good studies in theology is having good questions. And the better and richer your questions are, the more you can actually get out of the sources and the tradition, and the better you can sort of translate that for the needs and challenges of our time. So, I mean, if you're going into doctoral studies with a new set of questions and concerns, I think that augurs really, really well for a really rich program of studies.
Yeah, yeah. So really quick, give us a quick update on you. What's going on with your potatoes?
Oh, yeah. So last time we ended the episode, with me saying, well, the tomatoes are slowly but surely getting there and the potatoes are the absolute stars of the show.
Oh, yeah.
And then last week I just went out, you know, and they have been, they've just been like hopping out of the ground, which gives great joy to this Irishman. But a week ago I went out there and like spotted all these spots, like these browny blacky spots all over the leaves of the potato plants, and I thought, oh god. And it was, my worst fears were confirmed.
My worst fears as an Irishman, my worst fears as a gardener. Yeah,
it's potato blight. Our potatoes have been infected with a fungus commonly known as potato blight, which was the fungus which caused the Irish famine in the 19th century. So I think I've been touching into the collective unconscious of the Irish people and fearing the worst, that somehow the crop has failed again and we're going to be on thin gruel for the next while. But anyway, all is not lost. I did dig up one plant and I just saw that the potatoes are not rotten. There are some potatoes in there which are still edible. And I actually had some of them today and they tasted pretty good.
Good, good, good.
I mean, they're not extra large. You know, it's not going to be this extra large bumper crop, but we will get something of a potato crop, which I'm grateful for. It's my first year of really trying to be a gardener, and to lose the entire potato crop would have been sort of soul destroying.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, by the way, the whole incident did remind me of quite a dark Irish potato joke that I have to attribute to Adam Lalonde, who we lived with in Toronto.
Yeah.
And it's, no, okay, like warning, this is dark. So the joke is, how many potatoes does it take to kill an Irishman?
How many?
None. Anyway, I'm glad to say we will have some potatoes. And please God, no Irishmen will die.
Very good.
Just give you some other positive update from all our efforts to grow things. At Sunday Mass this weekend, I gave out tomato plants and herb plants, extra ones that we had grown but we couldn't sort of cultivate, so we just gave them away in pots.
Wow.
The parishioners just gleefully took them and brought these little tomato plants and herb plants home to plant in their own gardens and to grow, and so just creating a sense of people's love for the earth and for growing things, and yeah, it was really heartening.
Yeah, that's awesome, man. Hey, that's a good transition. We've come for the past couple of episodes into a good conversation and a long reflection on Catholic social teaching. And in this episode, we were going to take another theme, but instead of doing that, I thought it might just be best for us to maybe tie those last three episodes on Catholic social teaching that we did on various topics like care for God's creation. And as you're talking about with that communal element, maybe just to find a way of tying all that together with a little bit of more of a spiritual or a looking back, a recollective perspective, just to glean some things that we maybe didn't talk about as much or that we'd want to underline for an ongoing conversation of Catholic social teaching. And when we come back in the fall, we may pick up some of those themes again. But for now, I mean, I want to hand it over to you. I know you were talking to me before about some things that were on your mind as we were talking about all the themes. So on more of a foundational level, some things that we may be thinking about as we approach social questions.
Yeah, so I guess I'm thinking about some of the personal and spiritual resources and outlooks that Catholics need in order to really get involved with and remain involved with sort of the struggle for social justice. Being involved in the promotion of justice and social justice is still a spiritual act, and it's not simply taking a moral stance on issues and going for it, certainly not for the Christian. And one of the spiritual resources and gifts that is required is hope.
Yes.
Hope is always needed, because people who get involved in any kind of a struggle for justice, whether it be for environmental justice or for workers or for the pro-life issue, inevitably they're going to face the prospect of failure, of not succeeding in making the change that they want to see or seeing the changes in their lifetime. And that can be quite discouraging, to constantly be working for a particular cause and not to see much progress or even to see things getting worse. I'm quite aware of people who are environmental activists, and as they see the data that's coming in and the predictions that are coming in, more and more they are becoming downcast and even despairing.
Yeah.
Not just that things aren't getting better, but things are getting worse.
Wow.
And we're really digging ourselves into a hole that we won't be able to get out of. So how does a Christian retain hope in such a situation?
Mm.
that's a question that I think is quite pertinent. The same for somebody who works on behalf of workers or the low paid or the unborn or, you know, the poor or anything like that. It's easy to look out the world and say, well, things are getting worse.
Right.
How do you not lose hope?
Yeah.
That's a question.
That's a really good question. And maybe taking it from a different perspective too. I got to say, it's one of the things that I hear, not from a social perspective, but also even from a moral one, that in the confessional, I've often experienced as a priest that the one thing that I find most dejecting in the confessional isn't any particular sin that anybody confesses. I find that generally when people are in the confessional, anything that they could say is just an occasion for joy because they're there to be reconciled with God. But the only thing that I find myself raging against a little bit internally is when there's hopelessness, because it's so antithetical to the gospel to be desperate or to be hopeless. And so I find myself very much speaking truth into that darkness for that person and trying to help them come out of that despair, because where they are is precisely a place of hope, is that they're hoping in God's mercy. And so in the social question, I think it's a natural question to ask just because we see imminently around us so many consequences. So maybe one answer to the question is that to balance out the very imminent consequences also with the transcendental. And so I think part of the problem is that generally we teeter on these two extremes of either salvation, for example, is just our homeland in the beatific vision, and so none of the stuff here matters. And so, hey, I have this kind of fool's hope that all of this will work out in the end. Or there's this belief that, like, well, no, we have to really get our hands dirty now, but we forget that there's also an eternal homeland that we're striving for. So there's that kind of tension. But then the other tension in a spiritual way that we could say is, do we believe in God's active presence in these questions as well? So we had mentioned this before about how God very much labors in creation and God labors among us and with us and for us. We talked about this when we talked about the right to work with laborum exercens, is that God himself is presented to us as wanting to work, you know, the creation account, but also in Ignatius with the spiritual exercises that God labors. So, I mean, that's one of the ways that as an antidote to hopelessness is to realize, wait a minute, I'm not the principal agent for this, but God is. And how do I play second fiddle to his primary work? And it's not just sort of just to chalk it up to, well, God will take care of it, but it's to say, okay, I don't need to conquer this mountain. I just need to take a few steps into the valley and trust in his providence.
Right.
But it's difficult because you can't have that conversation with a secular mind. Typically, that's a very religious inside baseball conversation.
Yeah. I think one of the issues for Christians is how do you use our hope, or how does our hope in the afterlife and in the beatific vision and in being in union with God, how does that inspire hope for our action here on earth?
Yeah, that's right.
Because in the past, it's very easy to use the idea of heaven or the promise of heaven to actually discourage people or disincentivize people from taking action here on earth.
That's right.
So, oh, don't worry about how bad things are now. You'll go to heaven someday and everything will be fine.
Yeah.
And that's not the purpose of theological hope.
Just to throw in a parenthesis there, I think even worse still, at times we've abused that kind of theology and said, your poverty is actually good. It's like the closer you are to the dirt, the more likely it is you'll be in heaven. So
yeah,
like my inaction is even better to facilitate that, which is a horrible perversion of the gospel, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So I would say to people who are losing hope because the predictions of the future are negative or the current trajectory is negative, let's say going from bad to worse, well then your hope can't be based on success here on earth, the promise of success here on earth. It needs to be based and founded on something else reliable. And in the Christian tradition, hope is based on, I suppose, the good, the promise of the good. The good, the kingdom will be realized. We're sure of that at the end. We are on the winning side. Mm. And to be part, to be a member of, let's say, that winning team, to use a sports analogy, you're not required to succeed here on earth. You're not required. God's not asking you to solve the problem. God is asking you to resist evil and to work for the good.
Yeah. Yeah.
When you come to the pearly gates, and you know, we're all going to be judged, God's not going to look at you and say, did you solve climate change? Or did you put an end to liberal abortion laws or to euthanasia laws? Or
yeah, yeah.
Did you put an end to the abuse of low-paid workers, etc.? He's not going to ask you that question. He's going to say, did you do something? Did you try?
Yeah. Did you try? Did you try at all? Exactly.
And I have to say, that's where I find my hope from. It's like my hope is far into the future. I want to be able to look back and say, well, I tried.
Yeah.
And I tried for the sake of my nephews and their children and all the future generations.
Yeah.
Who rely on good functioning ecosystems, etc. I did try out of love for them and out of love for God.
Sure.
Who created all of this. So I think that's more a source of hope, to be able to imagine yourself in the future saying, yeah, I did try, and God giving some reward for that.
Yeah.
I put myself out the line, I made sacrifices. And it doesn't matter, really doesn't matter whether we succeeded or not.
That's right.
But that efforts in good faith were made.
Mm-hmm.
Because the alternative is to say, I don't care. Mm-hmm. I gave up, or I just didn't care in the first place. Not even that I tried and gave up, but I just didn't care.
Yeah, yeah.
That is despair, you know, is like not even trying. Hope is the virtue which enables us to do the good. Hope is the virtue that enables us to do the good. It's not the virtue which enables us to succeed.
That's great. Yeah.
It's the virtue which enables us to do the good, and especially when that good is hard to attain.
That's right.
This is Thomas Aquinas. That's when hope is really seen. When that good is difficult to attain. That's when hope, you know, when the going gets tough, hope gets going. That's a bit cheesy. I'm sorry.
That's pretty good though. Yeah, I mean, you're good. You're good. I like it.
Yeah. So you hear me. Like, so when the going gets tough, I suppose there's an option of, okay, do I despair of the good ever being realized, or do I still believe that far in the future, good will triumph, and I'm going to choose to be part of that team?
That's right. I think you're exactly right. And one of the things that's resonating with me with that is that it's the right thing to do to care for creation, even though I'm going to be horribly inefficient at solving it at a macro level. It's still the right thing to do to stand up for the unborn. It's still the right thing to do to stand up for workers. It's just right. It's just right to do. And so you're right. That's where I'm going to be judged. In my particular judgment, it'll be that, you know? And I think there are resonances there with the corporal works of mercy, is that it's a very personal invitation to doing something in front of you, which is that poor person in front of you who is in need of food and drink and clothing and sustainable living and work and all that, you do something for that person. And that's where my particular judgment will come down, is how did I respond to the very, very personal invitation? I'll just give you a quick anecdote. I had a really wonderful grace moment when I was a regent, that period of time when we teach high school typically. And I taught high school in Dallas for a couple of years, and it was a wonderful grace time. But I remember I struggled a lot my first year. I was there for 3 years, and I struggled my first year there for a lot of reasons. I was in my mid-20s and not my first time having a full-time job. But long story short, one of the things that I spoke to my spiritual director about that I was getting really frustrated by is that, you know, I'm a rank and file teacher. And I didn't always agree with how the administration or the board of trustees was planning out the future of the school. And I had opposing opinions and visions for the school. And it was causing a lot of anxiety in me and a lot of despair and frustration, because I felt like, where the heck are we going? Like, we're heading in the wrong direction. And I was telling my spiritual director this and how it was cultivating in me a lot of despair and frustration and anger. And he said to me, look, you're there to love and care for the kids in your classroom. Like, focus there. Look downward. Like, look down and not up at these big problems, but look down in front of you and see that you have 20 kids in front of you that are there for you to love and to care and to teach and to shepherd. And when I turned my focus downward like that towards the micro and not so much the macro, I found myself liberated from a lot of that despair, because I realized there is fruit here. It's small. And if I look at the macro level, all of this fruit seems trivial, but no. Like, this is good fruit here that could do good. And I think that your experience as a gardener recently, though we kind of joke about it, is a really beautiful one, that this is precisely the work of social justice and of evangelization, is that you're cultivating a small little garden hoping for the best, but look how you handed those plants off to people. And where are those plants going to end up? Where is that going to lead to maybe a blossoming in a new village? And I just find that turning your eyes downward, and maybe this is the incarnation principle again, towards the immediate fruit in front of you is a wonderful way to, as a good antidote to the despair that we might feel, you know, because you actually do start seeing the fruit that you otherwise discarded.
Yeah. Years ago, I read a beautiful spiritual book by Henri Nouwen. I think he's a Belgian spiritual writer. And it's called In the House of the Lord. And he contrasts some gospel values with worldly values, which are similar but different in important ways. And one of the contrasts was between fruitfulness, which is a gospel value, you know, the Lord asks us to go out and bear fruit, and efficiency or effectiveness, which is a worldly value, get things done in the quickest possible time and in the most efficient way and solve the problem. And it's not that there's anything wrong with solving problems, but just to say that the gospel value is fruitfulness, which is slightly different. It includes an aspect of growth, and maybe it's not quite as linear approach, and it's not an approach which is as easy as just planning and executing, but it means being close to the Lord, being close to people, and allowing good things to emerge, and things that some of which may be foreseen and some of which are unforeseen, that we're not totally in control of the process, but that we're part of it and contributing to it. So just to give an example from here, 2 weeks ago, I was out in the polytunnel and some of the local school children who are sort of, say, 6 years old came in and they were tending to their plants. And at the end of their little session, I just said, "Now, children, would you like a blessing?" And of course, I get the question, "Well, what's a blessing?" And which we've been through before. Doesn't mean PlayStations. But anyway, explained. And then immediately the teacher who was there with them just said, "Oh, yeah. And remember, children, none of these things would grow were it not for God sending the sun and the rain."
Mm, that's beautiful.
She totally said that spontaneously. And the children, you know, who love her, were really listening and soaking it up. And then I explained what a blessing was and I gave them a blessing. And it was just a beautiful moment that I could never have planned. I was just going out there to tend to the plants, and all of a sudden they're in and we're having this beautiful interaction. And I thought, wow, that was fruitfulness. That was gospel fruitfulness.
Yes, yes, yes.
Having a sense that, right, I'm part of something bigger here. And I just brought my gifts to that situation, and something quite beautiful came and the children all left very happy and feeling blessed.
Yeah, and filled with hope. And it filled you with hope. It filled you with hope.
Yeah, yeah. And you know what? Like there's still an awful lot of carbon dioxide and methane in the atmosphere. But that encounter and that experience filled me with hope and
yeah,
renewed my enthusiasm for what I'm trying to do.
That's awesome. It reminds me, just really quick, not to belabor the point, but just another beautiful anecdote that I think that was helpful for me to get my head around a little bit of this, because it does breed some hope. I was walking through the city of Miami with an architect, and he was saying, it's so sad to me that we have all of these massive towers now, and nothing is built on a human scale. And I never really thought about it that way, but he opened my eyes to a reality is that we stretch upwards and outwards with our infrastructure and our ingenuity, and perhaps a lot of these social problems have precisely to do with that, is that the overbuilding and the overconstruction and the overexpansion has really stretched the limits of our systems. He said, you know, everything when it's on a human level just makes a lot more sense in perspective to us. And he was talking about that as an architect. And I really think about that with this fruitfulness idea, is that if I think about efficiency, well, it's like, of course, like it's much better if we have a globalized society and we have tall towers and we have wide cities. But a fruitful idea would be that there's a human encounter that's facilitated by this. And when there's human encounter and there is putting your hands on someone to give them a blessing or helping someone till the soil, that human encounter immediately pays its dividends in fruitfulness, because you see the effect immediately in that human encounter, and it's on the right proportion to us. So like if you ask me to lower the carbon emissions in the world or to cease the abortion industry and all that, that's such a massive proportion. But the proportion that's most appropriate to me is one person to love and to care and to bless. And that fills me with tremendous hope, you know, because I can do that. I can achieve, if that's the right word, you know?
Yeah. The other angle I wanted to take on social, the other sort of spiritual angle to take on social issues is the angle of the church, that we do want to engage with these issues as communities of believers. And that can still be on a personal scale. It doesn't mean that we, all of a sudden, the Pope sort of comes out with this plan for the entire global church to execute. But it means that we are coming together with our brothers and sisters in Christ and doing something at a local or national level that we could not do on our own as individuals.
Right.
If we were to look ahead, what would our hope be, say, for 100 years' time? I would hope that in 100 years' time, historians could look back and say, Christians here didn't solve all these problems, but they did come together and they did try and they did make real efforts that were fruitful and didn't solve the problem, but they didn't just sit in their hands or they didn't lose hope, but they came together and they did achieve something. So to give an example, historians can look back now at the period of the Second World War and they can say that Christians didn't prevent Hitler from rounding up Jews and exterminating them or trying to exterminate Jews in prison camps. But Christians were active in one, resisting him, and in actually bringing a lot of Jews to safety.
Yeah.
So I think that's the kind of thing I'm aiming for when faced with these big issues. It's like, okay, you can't have the yardstick as success of all these evils being defeated or done away with, but Christians did come together and did make a difference.
Right.
For me, that's Christ active in the world. And then leaving, I suppose, the final victory of good over evil to Christ and at the end of history.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Like, where was the church in that moment of history? Or are we completely absent from that? And if we're leaven in the dough, you may not always see us explicitly, but we should at least have an effect. We should at least have some fruitfulness in this behavior, in this experience. Or are we so detached? And I think this goes back to the incarnational principle again, is that we're at least need to be a part of the conversation and a part of the public square. Like, this is the social conversation on its most abstract and most basic, which is that we have a not just a basic option for social questions, but this is also so essential to our faith that if we're absent from that, then we're really chipping away at even what our identity is as Catholics, as church. If the church at the time of the Second World War wasn't the one that was leading the charge, but at the very least, like, we have a moral duty and a moral obligation to not be silent in these moments. And if we do, then we're really chopping away at the root of our faith, which is that Jesus became a man in a particular context. And in that context, he didn't just stay silent. And I guess it goes back to that final judgment question, is that, did I stay silent? Jesus can ask me that at the final judgment. When your brother was being beaten, did you say anything? And if you didn't, then, well, what does it say about your real faith and belief in these people, you know?
Yeah.
No, that's good, man. I like that. Let me just throw one more detail into our reflection on Catholic social teaching. And that is, I want to just mention, because we don't talk about this too explicitly, but the Catholic social question is often one that's talked about very triumphantly and very well with questions of social science and questions of philosophy, theology generally, and how we can best plan or do and affect, which is great. And that's the action question. But don't forget, in that paradigm that we were talking about at the beginning, is that there's experience, and we do have an experience of tremendous injustices, but we don't go from there to action. There's that reflection piece in the middle, but it's not just reflection in the social science way. That's essential. I just want to speak the word prayer into this conversation, is how are we praying about these issues. So I've been thinking a lot about this subtle distinction that I've been bringing up a lot in spiritual direction with people, because sometimes people say things like, well, okay, I have a big decision to make, so I'm going to pray about it. I'm going to pray about it. And I thought, praying about, that kind of sounds a little bit like what you're trying to say is you're going to think about it a lot. They're going to sit there and just sort of like ruminate on this. And so I push on people and I say, when you say pray about, what does that actually mean? And I think with the social questions in particular, we can say, well, I really want to pray about this. What kind of engagement is God calling me to? I think another preposition other than about is to use the one with. How do you pray with something? So do you hold it in your heart before the Lord? In your heart, the injustice is around you. Or is it just like, I'm going to pray about this and think about what kind of engagement I'm going to do? And it just becomes this thinking process. Or do you really sit with some of that tension? Like, do you know people who suffer, and can you bring them to the Lord in prayer and sit with them and intercede for them before the Lord? And I think that's a really beautiful way to remind ourselves that there's a mysticism too to our social action. It's not just social action for the sake of political change. It's also that, like, to forge the bonds of communion between us, the Lord has to be a part of that. And I find praying with the people that suffer, praying with the people that I care for in the presence of the Lord, that means in my heart, like carrying them in there, is important. And I find that that's one way that I can also cultivate hope, is because I'm encouraging the presence of the Holy Spirit and God in this crisis, and not just, all right, God, like, here's a random petition, fix this. It's like, okay, that's good. That's a genuine prayer. But am I really actually experiencing, cultivating empathy in me for the plight of the single mother who's being yelled at because she's struggling with questions about abortion or not? Can I pray with her, both like actually with her, sit with her and pray to God for her? And can I also carry her and her child to the Lord in my own private prayer and let my heart become alive with empathy? And I think there's hope there, right? Because then it becomes not just about me solving her problems, but really inviting the Lord to take the lead.
Yeah, and that's the prayer, I suppose, of a missionary disciple, Dave, where there's a temptation in prayer to constantly be asking for things. It's like, please give me good health, or give my family good health, or please let my son find a job. And there are good things to pray for, of course. But as a missionary disciple, you're trying to pray in a way that will leave you open to responding to situations yourself. Like, Lord, here's this difficult situation. Speak, Lord, like your servant is listening. I'm here. I don't want to rush in thinking that I have all the answers and I can, you know, I can fix everything. Clearly, that's not the case. But I'm willing to respond, and please guide me so that I can respond in a fruitful way.
Yeah.
To put it that way.
Yeah.
So it does sort of reverse the direction of the prayers. So it's not just God doing things for me, but it's me becoming a servant of the Lord and hopefully being part of his redemptive action in the world. So yeah, prayer is essential to that. Prayer is absolutely essential.
Right, right.
You know, Lord, please guide my steps.
Yeah, and I think maybe the witness of Jesus in the Gospels is a great one, is that he often went away and spent time in prayer. I mean, he could have spent more time flipping tables in the temple if he wanted to, but he also spent time with the Lord, his Father, in solitude and in the mountain. I think it's a really beautiful reminder that if Jesus himself wants to be effective or fruitful, he knows that he has to be constantly in communion with his Father. And it's not to be overly transcendental in our vision of heaven or something, like we were saying before, but it's just to realize that that constant connection that Jesus has with his Father is precisely what gives him the fruitfulness that he so desires in his ministry, because whatever the Father has, I give to you. And he is constantly with his Father to receive. And the same thing with us. Like, what do you have to offer? And what do I have to offer? And what do the apostles say in the book of Acts? It's like, silver and gold I have not, but what I do have, I give you. And that is a word of hope and resurrection. And I don't know. That's good news for me.
I like that.
Yeah, buddy.
Thanks for bringing that in, Dave. Yeah.
Sure.
You truly are a son of Ignatius, encouraging us to pray about these things.
Yeah, man. Yeah, man.
Ignatius would definitely pray about it. That's for sure.
Yes, absolutely. Ignatius is always, always very concerned about what does God have to say about this. Ignatius and the first companions, for example, when they were talking about whether or not they should found an order, it was very clear that Ignatius and the first companions said, okay, well, we need to spend time praying about this and discerning this together. And then whatever God's will is, even Ignatius didn't want to be the first superior general of the order, but he accepted it because it was unanimous. And they understood that the Spirit was very much working in their communal discernment. And so I think it's a really beautiful sign that in Ignatius, our charism is very much predicated on that, is that we don't act first. We experience God, we experience and we reflect and we pray, and then we act and we respond. Like, all of our action and social action is a response to crisis, but also a response to an invitation from the Lord to be engaged. And I think that might be a paradigm shift for me, is that I'm responding because I'm listening, and that listening is happening in my social life and political life, but also in my spiritual life. And if I'm not listening, then what the heck am I doing? But I'm just living my life in a bubble.
Speaking of responding, I want to just say thank you to the various listeners who have written into the podcast with feedback, and often positive feedback about the show. And I'm really grateful for that, because I really enjoy these conversations with you, Dave. And it just brings extra joy to know that others are enjoying it too, and getting something from it. So thank you to everyone who's written in with words of encouragement and with suggestions. And also to say hello and thank you to Emma, who is our new producer. John was doing the sound editing on this podcast, and John has handed over to Emma. So thank you, Emma, for taking on this service. And we're really glad to have you on board.
Yeah, for sure. And just a shout out to Stateside. I've been sharing the podcast with our vocation team, and they have been handing on the episodes of the show to guys who are taking it more seriously to discern a vocation of the Society of Jesus. And I've gotten some good feedback that men who are considering, young men who are considering a vocation, find just our conversations to be illuminating and helpful, like not labored. Our conversations aren't sort of like always hammering over the head of like, you must be a Jesuit or anything. But I think people just find that there's a natural, organic conversation between two Jesuits that is inspiring them. And I've gotten good feedback from men discerning, and I know you've received the same. And so I just want to affirm that and give thanks to God for that, but also shout out to those guys who are discerning and saying that we're praying for them, and that if these conversations are helpful at all, we're very grateful that you're listening, for sure.
Maybe we could do a few episodes at some point next year more explicitly for young men who are discerning their vocations to the society or priesthood. I think that might be a good way to go.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, good. Well, with that, you know, just to say it more explicitly, I think we've dropped a hint a few times. And as you just said, so this will be the last episode of what we may call season one of our show that we've started since last fall or earlier this spring. And it's been a wonderful time, Niall. And I've very much loved these conversations and look forward to continuing them. And so we'll be on a bit of a pause the next couple of weeks as I transition to Madrid and Niall takes some much needed vacation over the summer.
Yes.
Woo-hoo. There may be some small little episodes, bite-sized, that we record individually. Maybe I'll record on my phone as I'm waiting for my airplane or something. And then we'll just drop in periodically. But we'll be back maybe late August or early September with a new season of the show.
Yes. I'm really looking forward to it, Dave. And yeah, thanks again for all your time and effort. And it's been really good.
Absolutely. Yeah, and thanks to you too. All right, buddy. And so we'll see you next fall for next season of Sons of Ignatius podcast.
Take care, everyone. Thank you.